paso al barranco.
This is a gathering of three Bhakti Riksha groups plus some friends, right? Huh? Three plus. So, on the way, on the half hour car ride on the way over here, we considered about 10 different possible things to discuss. Maybe we could do so many things. But the request that prevailed was to have something of a theme while here. And since in the Bhakti Vriksha groups and in general, what I've been told is there's a lot of Bhagavad Gita discussion and disproportionately not as much Srimad Bhagavatam discussion, so this is a Srimad Bhagavatam visit. Which fits, very much fits in with what I'd like to do. Please don't do that. So, this isn't going to be in a sequence, what I'm going to do while visiting here, at least. When I leave Seattle, I'm going to Vrindavan for some very delightful meetings. And then after the meetings, for the Festival of Inspiration. During the Festival of Inspiration, I'll be making a couple of presentations. I'll make the trial run here. You're the guinea pigs? Or something like that. You get to hear it first. So I don't know the sequence yet because this was just a discussion on the way. But one night or one time can be kids, either night or Saturday morning or something that's really good for kids. Few kids in Seattle congregation. Shaman Taka Jewel. With lots of pictures and very nice story. Then another Krishna returns to Mathura from Vrindavan. Apura comes, Apura leaves. Takes Krishna, the gopis, entering into the Jamuna, meeting all the people that he meets and the stories behind them, who they were before they were Kubja and Kubavyapida and the wrestlers. And that'll be fun. Lots of nice pictures. So this evening, just because it's all a little bit of a surprise. I'm just going to continue where I think I left off with the sixth canto. This evening is sixth canto continued. And what I do remember is the basement of someone's home showing the picture of Ritrasura. So I'll come right after the Vritrasura story, I'll begin. So, for sake of review, for those who attended the earlier six canto discussions, and for those who didn't, you can remind them or share with them. What is the theme of the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam? Can anybody remember? Or does anybody have an understanding of how the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam fits in with the rest of the Srimad Bhagavatam? Well, The long pause will help you remember when I say it. You dredge your memory, see if you can recall something. I'll prod your memories. In the first story that's narrated in the sixth canto is about who? Ajamila. Now what does the Ajamila story illustrate?
Glories of the Holy Name.
And the glories of the Holy Name in contrast with what? Yeah. Karmakanda atonement process for counteracting sinful reactions. What else? In contrast with what else? Jnanakanda. Okay, we're getting there. So, the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is describing the superlative position of Bhagavad Dharma in contrast with Karmakanda and Jnanakanda. Another quiz question. This message is the central message also of the key verse of Nectar of Devotion. What is the principal verse, Mahavakya, of Nectar of Devotion, or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu? Anyabhilashita shunyam jnanakarmad yanavratam anukulyena krishnanushilana Bhakti Uttama. So the first two lines summarize what the sixth canto is about. Anya Avilash Shunya. Which specific Avilash? Jnana and Karma Avilash. Anavratam. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is educating the audience in the principles of Bhagavad Dharma. The sixth canto, the title of the whole canto, is the duties, prescribed duties of mankind. So most people, when they think of prescribed duties of mankind, they think of varnashram, their duties as a grihastha, if you're a grihastha, and your particular varna, brahmana, kshatriya, vaishya, or shudra, dharma. And so do your duties and avoid neglecting your duty. And if there's mistakes in your duty, you undergo some atonement or prayaschitta for those duties that have some flaw. So the Vedas have many directions about performance of those kinds of duties. And generally the motivation behind those kinds of duties are material benefit, explicitly. Different types of health, wealth, longevity, marriage, birth, prosperity, having success in some undertaking, having a successful journey, etc., 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 etc. So, the end of the fifth canto, the second third of the fifth canto describes the structure of the universe. Vedic cosmology, or cosmography. Part of the cosmography of the universe is there's upper planets, middle planets, and the ones we don't like planets. Hellish planets. And after hearing the description of the hellish planets, Maharaj Parikshit begins the sixth canto with asking a classic theological question. That is, what can be done to prevent people from having to experience reactions for their sinful deeds and enter into a hellish condition in the hellish planets? It's a universal theological question. It's asked in the Bhagavatam in the sixth canto, and the reply comes in sequence: Karmakanda, and that's not adequate. Gyanakanda, that also, with Karmakanda and Gyanakanda, it's not adequate. It's not adequate in this sense. The tendency, although Prayaschitta can counteract the reactions of previous misdeeds, the tendency to do more of them is still there. Like clipping the top of a dandelion weed. The root's still there. It's going to grow again. You clip it again, grow it again. You have to remove from the root. So, Gyanakanda can also, knowledge we know from Bhagavad Gita, knowledge can counteract volumes of sinful activity and serves as some kind of a deterrent from doing wrong things. Persons in knowledge know better. But that's not sufficient either, because people who know better still do wrong things. Even us. Even those who have knowledge and devotion, we may know something will be beneficial, we should do it. We don't do it consistently. And things that we know that we shouldn't do, we sometimes do them, even though we know we shouldn't do them. Knowledge alone is not enough. So, what's the solution? The solution the Bhagavatam presents is Bhagavad Dharma, exemplified by the glorification of the personality of Godhead, starting with His holy name, especially for this age, and so the Ajami of the story is narrated. The antidote for sinful reactions and even sinful tendencies is Bhagavad Dharma, crowned by the chanting of the holy name. It doesn't mean we chant the holy name, we can do any foolish thing. That's an offense against the holy name. We must stop making offenses to the holy name with great reverence and devotion to the holy name. So that's narrated. And then there's another section, cluster of chapters, where the same principle is discussed from another perspective, the contrasting position. What's the next story? Who can remember? Daksha and Narada. Daksha and Narada. After hearing about the Ajamila story, Shukadeva Goswami is asked, he starts to describe something, that a continuation from the fourth canto, and that is the Prachetas, who had entered into the ocean or sea for undergoing austerities for 10,000 years. They had darshan of Lord Vishnu. By the mercy of Lord Shiva, he gave them a stotra to chant, that he chants, worshipping Vishnu. Vishnu came, gave them a benediction. When they came out, nice pictures. Look at this. Oops. While in the ocean, they saw Lord Vishnu. When they came out, they were seeing that vegetation had spread everywhere. And so in a mood of anger, they wanted to clear the land, because they were the Prajetas. They were taking responsibility for giving protection to the people, so they, to clear the land, from their mouths came fire and intense wind. There's nine prajetas. There's one at the bottom, one at the middle at the bottom, one over at the left at the bottom. You see the torches coming out of their mouth. Fire torches. So, burning the vast forests, and Chandra, or Soma, the god of the moon, came and pleaded with them, please stop. You've done a good job, but you don't have to destroy all the forests. And they calmed down and submitted to Soma, and so he gave them benediction. He gave them a very wonderful wife, Pramlocha, with whom they begot a son who is named Daksha. This is Daksha part one. Daksha offended Lord Shiva, and Virabhadra came and chopped off his head, and you see the demons attacking Daksha. Daksha was given a goat's head. Daksha came and apologized, offered profuse prayers to Lord Shiva, and several yugas later he was born as Daksha part two. So anyway, so there's this, I'm not going to go through all the pictures and the whole narration. Daksha was very expert at Karmakanda, and although he was a devotee, he also had this mixed Karmakanda interest, Karma Mishra Bhakti. And in contrast, Narada is Shuddha Bhakti. So there was a conflict between Daksha part two and Narada. And with the, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, the message is that pure devotion is stronger than mixed devotion. Let's see. Daksha, the sons, the Savalashvas and the Hariashvas, were brought to the stage of pure devotion by Narada, the sons of Daksha. Daksha became very angry at Narada, thinking, you've deprived them of the benefit of experiencing the happiness of material life through Karmakanda, becoming householders, responsible and virtuous householders, learning how to fix their minds upon the Supreme Lord and detaching themselves from worldly attraction and eventually becoming perfected. Instead, you've taken them directly to the stage of devotion, and so you're an enemy of the principles of religion. So he cursed him. He cursed him that he would play his veena and travel forever, that he couldn't stay in one place for more than a few days. Narada was pretty rolls. Narada came specifically to deliver that message to Daksha so that he could deliver Daksha. Deliver the message of pure devotion to Daksha. Because once Daksha got over his anger, Narada was able to preach to him. In this same way, Narada was able to deliver so many persons. Here's a picture of Narada with Dhruva. And the descendants of Diti are described. I'm not going to go through all that. That's one chapter, the descendants of Diti. And the chapter ends with a discussion about one of these sons of Diti, whose name was Trashta. Yeah. One of the sons of Diti, whose name was Trashta, had two sons, Sannivesh and Vishwaroop, and it was said that Indra, after offending Brihaspati, left, Vishwarup became his replacement spiritual master, and then Indra killed Vishwarup. So there's like a five chapter detour where Maharishi Parikshit says, can you say more about that? And in that whole narration is again on the theme of the contrast of karma kanda or karma mishra bhakti and shuddha bhakti. Because that's the theme of the canto. The paramount position of shuddha bhakti, and where shuddha bhakti does not depend upon prior qualification, including birth, because the shuddha bhakta in this case is a demon by birth. Vritrasura, he's an asura who is produced from a yajna fire by Tvashta. So he was the son of Tvashta coming out of a fire, fire yajna, through mantra. So in one sense he was a Brahmin, and his brother Vishwarup was also a Brahmin. But he was an enemy of Indra. In fact, the mantra was specifically to create an enemy of Indra who would kill him, because Indra had killed Vishwarup, the son of Tvashta, the older brother of Vishwarup, of Vritrasura. So here's, in the back, sitting on the throne is Indra, Indra having a big Indra party, glorifying himself. In Indra Loka, Brihaspati seeing how proud is this Indra, and so he just walked out of the assembly. And when the whole party was over, Indra was realizing he made a big mistake. He had offended Brihaspati by neglecting his spiritual master. And so they set out in all directions to find Brihaspati. And then it's a long story, so it's several chapters long. The demons took over and killed the demigods. Then Indra went to Brahma, help, help, what do I do? And Brahma suggested, why don't you go to the son of Tvashta and he'll help you. Here's Indra giving advice, Brahma giving advice to Indra. So they went to Vishwarup. There you see him on the right-hand side with three heads. Interesting form, huh? And Vishwarup, long story, but he danced around the idea of becoming their spiritual master, but finally agreed. And he gave to Indra the Narayan Kavacha mantra. And with this Narayan Kavacha mantra, Indra was protected. Indra came back to attack the demons. The demons fled in fear. Indra was very happy with Vishwarup. The demons were chased and defeated, and Indra was happy again. Indra gets unhappy when he loses, and really happy when he wins. He's on the platform of duality, in other words. When you have material desire, then that's what happens. You know duality. Happy when you have, and unhappy when you lose what you have, or don't get what you want. That's Indra, all over the place. But he's really happy with Vishwarup. Then he gets unhappy with Vishwarup because Vishwarup performs yajnas, karma kanda yajnas, to produce soma rasa for the devas. Only Vishwarup's mother was the son of Diti. Tvashta was the son of Aditi, and the wife of Tvashta, the wife of Tvashta was the daughter of Diti. So, out of respect for his mother, Vishwarup provided Somarasa for some of the daityas. And Indra didn't like that at all. And so he came and cut off the head of Vishwarup, all three of them. And then he realized, uh-oh, I've done a very terrible thing. So this is a lesson from this karma kanda. Even a good person can do some really bad things. He's not just a good person, he's not just in heaven, he's the king of heaven. But look, by attachment to material desire, one can do very bad things and then have to suffer for those very bad things. So he thought, maybe you should get another Brahmin and do some prayaschitta. And then he thought, no, I'll just accept the reaction. So he underwent austerities, and while he was doing those austerities, Tvashta was not at all satisfied. That Indra has got to learn his final lesson. He should be killed for killing a Brahmin. Innocent, the Brahmin that had helped him when he was at Vasta's kingdom, he got his kingdom back, and then he killed him, my son. So he created, from a mantra, a karma kanda mantra. He uttered the mantra that was to create a demon who would be the enemy of Indra and would kill Indra. But he uttered the mantra with one syllable mistake. So he got exactly the opposite result. Instead of the demon that would kill Indra, it was a demon that would be killed by Indra. One syllable. Another evidence that karma kanda is, you know, if you had, as Tvashta, was a qualified priest, and who has such qualified priests that can do this? One syllable mistake. But we don't have those qualified priests in this age of Kali. Another evidence that karma kanda is not to be, it's not intended, it's not effective for this age. What to speak of the superior position of Bhagavat Dharma. So here's Vritrasura, created by Vedic mantra to be a demon who would be killed by Indra. So, not as attractive, is it? So, Vritrasura, so powerful, so big, he could uproot trees and carry this huge trident. And the armies of the demigods were defeated by the Daityas, so Indra became unhappy again. He lost his kingdom again. So they went to Lord Vishnu, please help. And Lord Vishnu gave them some advice. You go to Dadichi, and you ask Dadichi for his bones. So Dadichi played around with them a little bit, and then he gave up his body and gave his bones to Indra. Then Indra took the bones to Vishvakarma, fashioned a thunderbolt that would be able to kill Vritrasura, and off the demigods go again to have combat with Vritrasura. There's Indra raising his club, and there's Vritrasura raising his trident. There's a better picture. BBT art is much better, huh? So, in the exchange between Vritrasura and Indra, Indra realizes he's not just this giant-bodied asura. By the way that Vritrasura speaks, he could understand his consciousness. His consciousness was a pure devotee of the Supreme Lord. And so Indra didn't know what to do. You see, at the foot of Vritrasura, all those soldiers, see how tiny the soldiers are in comparison to Vritrasura? See the elephant down there? This little one, like his big toe in size. So Indra, being a very powerful warrior, but at the same time a devotee, he was caught off guard, in imbalanced position. What to do? There's this terrible demon fighting against the demigods, but at the same time, he's not just a demon, he's an unusually gifted pure devotee. So then Vritrasra had to preach to him, look, this is what Vishnu wanted. He gave you that thunderbolt to kill me. So use it. It's what the Supreme Lord wants. How can you stop? And when you use it, Indra, you'll get your kingdom. That's what you want. And when you use it, I'll get what I want. I'll go back to the spiritual world. You get what you want, I get what I want. And Indra, I don't want your kingdom. I don't want your wealth. I don't want your power and influence. I only want to be engaged in the eternal association of our Lord Vishnu. And I want the association of Narada, Narada Muni, and all such wonderful associates. And he goes off into this whole direction of intense glorification of Lord Vishnu and praise to Lord Vishnu. Please engage me in your eternal service. And Indra is stunned. Who are you? You certainly don't look like the words that you're speaking. And so Vritrasara, having a mission of being the enemy of Indra, who will be killed by Indra, he throws his trident at Indra, and Indra then comes out of his dullness and uses the thunderbolt weapon and zaps the trident into little pieces, and then he cuts off one of Vritrasara's arms, and then Vritrasara swallows Indra. He has this giant mouth. So then Indra comes out of the belly of Vritrasara. Then he cuts off his other arm, then he cuts off his head. And after cutting off his head, the demigods are happy, but Indra realizes he was a Brahmin, he was a great devotee. And so he's pursued by sinful reaction personified in the shape of an old, haggardly lady bleeding from her body like someone who has tuberculosis and smelling like that too, and saying, Indra, come here. And Indra's running for his life and can't get away. So finally Indra hides in the stem of a lotus. So in Vritrasara, when he's killed, he goes back to Godhead, and Indra's got to hide underwater, hanging out with fish for 100 years just to avoid the sinful reaction of killing Vritrasara, because Vritrasara was the result of his killing Vishwarupa, and Vishwarupa was the result of his being envious because some daityas were getting somarasa from the Karmakanda Yajna. You know, the intrigue of materialistic affairs is so convoluted. So there's the contrast. Vritrasara, despite birth, his consciousness is that of a Mahabhagavat Vaishnav. And Indra, despite his position being the king of heaven, having very strong material desires and attached to Karmakanda rituals and all the fruits that come from Karmakanda rituals, look what his position is. And it happens again and again and again and again and again and again. Because Bhagavat Dharma, the position of pure devotion, it's unmixed. Jnana Karma Dhyanavritam Anyabhilashata Shunyam. That position has to be reached. Another quiz question. Can anybody remember the key verse that comes in the first canto of this chapter that's spoken by Shukadev Goswami? How can sinful reactions be checked for those that are destined to receive them and experience them in a hellish condition? Kechit. Kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayana agham dunvanti karchneya niharam eva bhaskaram. So Vritrasura is the example of the Kevala Bhakta, and Indra is the example of Karma Mishra Bhakta. So, that's where we ended up. That was all review. Now, when Maharaj Parikshit hears this story, he asks Shukadeva Goswami, "This is very mysterious." He goes through a similar presentation like Lord Chaitanya does with Sanatan Goswami. He says, in this world there are so many species of life, and out of those so many species of life there's a small portion of them that are humans. Of those that are human, most people are just engaged in unregulated go-for-it sense gratification. Of those, some understand that there is a religious purpose to life. Of those that understand it, hardly any really know what it is. And of those who really know what it is, hardly any of them follow it. And of those that follow it, hardly any of them understand what the purpose behind it is. And of those that understand the purpose behind it, very few apply themselves in a conscientious way towards that. Of those, some are devotees. And of those, some are pure devotees. So, how is this person who's born in the Asura category come to this position? How does this happen? Who was he before he was Vritrasura? And so, that sets up a whole other several chapter narration about amongst many millions who are liberated and perfect the knowledge of liberation, one may be devotee of Lord Narayan. Such devotees who are fully peaceful are extremely rare. So the phrase Muktanam api siddhanam Narayana Parayana, this phrase Narayana Parayana appears in the first chapter, Vasudeva Parayana, and here Narayana Parayana, and again in chapter 17, Narayana Parayana. It's my appreciation of the poetry of the Bhagavatam, where phrases carry very powerful meaning. Just a little phrase, as Prabhupada would speak sometimes, just again and again a certain phrase, and the number of times that he used it just like invested in that short phrase some very, very deep meaning for those that are accustomed to hearing Prabhupada speaking. So this phrase Narayana Parayana is like that. Narayana Paraksarge Nakotaschana Bibhuti Svarga Apavarga Narakeshu Apito Yarta Darshan. This comes in the upcoming chapters. Vasudeve Bhagavati, same, there's this phrase that comes in the first canto, Bhakti Yoga Prayojataha Janayati Ashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayada Haitakam. Same idea in the 17th chapter. What this sixth canto is doing is setting apart Bhagavat Dharma from Karmakanda and Jnanakanda. So, Jnana, Vairagya, Viryanam. So, perfect knowledge and detachment are byproducts of the bhakti process. One doesn't need to separately go into Karmakanda to get neutralized from reactions of sins, or go into Jnanakanda to get knowledge. Just engage in devotional service. Persons engaged in devotional service to Lord Vasudeva Krishna have naturally perfect knowledge and detachment from this world. Therefore, such devotees are not interested in the so-called happiness and so-called distress of this world. Nahi kashit vyapashraya. This is the message at the end of the chapter that's being the storyline is telling us. So Shukadeva Goswami describes who was this Vritrasura previously? He was King Chitraketu. And here's how it happened that he became Vritrasura. King Chitraketu was a very pious king and a great devotee. He also had some interest in karmakanda, because while his kingdom was flourishing and he was such a pious king, everyone in his kingdom was benefiting from his piety. Everybody was in a state of full happiness, obedience to the king, contented with his leadership. Everybody was happy except one person. You want to guess who that one person was? It wasn't his wife. It was him. He was unhappy. He was unhappy because he had a material desire that was not fulfilled. And that material desire happened to be something that was beyond his capacity to do anything about. He wanted a son. And Kritadyuti, if I remember correctly, is his wife's name. No son was coming. So, this happens in Vedic literature sometimes. It happens in life sometimes. No son, no children. So, what Chitraketu did was, he accepted a second queen. Again, no son. A third queen. No son. 10 queens. 100 queens. 1,000 queens, 10,000 queens. He's going to pass Krishna in 16,000. 100,000 queens. He had a lot of queens. Let me get the exact number here. Huh? 100,000? I think it's more. Yes. 10 million! Now, there's a certain point of just accepting Krishna's arrangement, right? Chitraketu was not accepting Krishna's arrangement. And so, recognizing the suffering condition of King Chitraketu, Angira Muni paid him a visit. There's Angira Muni sitting in that nice seat there. And Angira Muni was received because Chitraketu was a great personality. So he received him very wonderfully, all proper reception, all proper arrangements. And Chitraketu literally sat at the feet of the sage. And the sage inquired, "My dear king, are you happy? You have all reason to be happy." And he lists all the wonderful things that are there in his kingdom. "My dear king, I hope that your body and mind and your royal associates and paraphernalia are well, when the seven properties of material nature, the total material energy, the ego, and the five objects of sense gratification are in order, the living entity within the material elements is happy. Without these seven elements, one cannot exist. Similarly, a king is always protected by seven elements. His instructor, spiritual master, his ministers, his kingdom, his fort, his treasury, his royal order, and his friends. King Chitraketu, all those things are in nice array in your kingdom. O King, O Lord of humanity, when a king directly depends upon his associates and follows their instructions, he is happy. In other words, he's not autocratic to the point where he doesn't pay attention to his ministers. He takes the advice of his ministers and he executes the advice of the ministers. Then the king is happy, the ministers are happy, things are conducted nicely, and you're doing all those things. You have such this wonderful situation, King Chitraketu. O King, are your wives citizens, secretaries and servants, and the merchants who sell spices and oil under your control? Are you also in full control of ministers, the inhabitants of your palace, your provincial governors, your sons, and your other dependents? That a king's mind is fully controlled, all his family members and government officers are subordinate to him. That's a very important message. For a king to control the subjects and those surrounding him, he's got to control his mind. And conversely, the opposite. If you can't control your mind, look out, for so many other things will be in disarray. His provincial governors present taxes on time without resistance, and what to speak of lesser servants. Oh, King Chitraketu, I can observe that although these things are in place, you're not happy. Please tell me, what is that disturbance? And King Chitraketu falls at the feet of Angira Muni and says, my dear sage, before you even came here, you knew the answer to that question. That's why you came here. You came here to give your very kind and merciful association, but you're asking just out of your kindness for me. So I'll tell you. I want a son. I want a son. It's my duty, I'm the king. I have to have a son who will carry on the throne, and I have to have a son who will... He gave all these religious reasons. I have to have a son who will deliver the forefathers. It's my duty. I'm a pious king. I have all these karmakanda duties I have to do. I want a son. But providence hasn't arranged that I would have a son. You're a great sage. Surely there's something you can do. Please help me. Considering the situation, Angira Muni agreed. He agreed that he would provide a son for Chitraketu, but the condition was that the son he would prename as Harshashoka. Happiness and distress. Do you agree? Chitraketu said, supposing the son is sometimes disobedient. That's okay, I can take that. Sometimes disobedient, sometimes obedient. It'll be a disturbance, but better that than no son. Yes, I agree. So Angira Muni performed the yajna, provided the havasham for the king. The king then gave to his wife Kritajyoti, and sure enough, in course of time, a son was born. And the happiness of the king increased and increased. And the happiness of Krishna Dyuti increased. And the happiness of the kingdom increased and increased. And everybody was happy. Except 9,999,999 co-wives. We want a son too. Krita Duty's getting all the attention, and what about us? And unfortunately, Chitraketu wasn't paying any attention to them. He was absorbed in his son, Harshashoka. The chief queens began talking amongst themselves. Better that we become a maidservant of Krita Duty and then we'll get some attention from Chitraketu. This way we're getting no attention at all. Then it got worse. They started making a plot to get rid of the sun. And then they acted on the plot. They, in the middle of the night, they came and poisoned the boy. They killed him. And when the morning came, Krita Duti awoke thinking of her beloved little boy, told the nurse, please bring him so I can feed him. And she went to see the boy, and she saw the boy's eyes were glazed, he wasn't breathing, and she screamed. So Krita Duti knew what that sound was like, and so she came running and saw the dead child, and she screamed and fainted. Meanwhile, one of the servants ran to get King Chitraketu, and he was tripping over his robe and running and falling, and he knew because he was told, your son is dead. He didn't want to believe it. And when he got there, he also lost consciousness. So king and queen unconscious on the floor. All the servants are wailing, crying. They were happy, now it's unhappy. Harshashoka. And so, just at that moment, Narada Muni arrived with his good friend Angira Muni. And they, together they spoke transcendental knowledge to the deeply lamenting Chitraketu and Krita Duti. And it's 8:15. And I think we're going to have to continue another time. The transcendental knowledge spoken by Angira and Narada. It's worth it to go through what they speak. So this is our Bhagavad Gita class. It's the same message of Bhagavad that Krishna speaks to Arjuna. The language is different. The message is the same message. Chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita is coming up. You know, only in the Bhagavatam. How to understand, how to detach oneself from the position of lamentation over the temporary body by fixing one's consciousness on the eternal soul. And there are several sections in the Bhagavatam. This is one of those several sections that would be, it's very good, I'm pausing because it's very good for devotees to learn these passages very, very carefully, because as Narada and Angira are in the position of sadhus having to pacify the grieving relatives of a deceased member of the family, we'll all be in a situation like that. Everyone here in this room, one time or many times during your life, will be in that spiritual position of having to pacify those who have lost a very dear friend or relative. Because it happens. And so it's very, very, it's worth a detailed review of what Narada and Angira say. And actually, it's so important that it happens three times in this section. first Angira speaks, or Angira and Narada speak, then the King Chitraketu comes a little bit out of his grieving state and he asks, who are you with this wisdom that you're imparting? And Angira says, don't you remember? I'm Angira Muni, I'm the one that gave you your son. You're so absorbed in lamentation, you don't even know who you are, who I am. And so then they speak again. And then later, the son comes back to life and he speaks again. Three times. So, I don't know what happened here. Oh, I see. Garland's falling in. So, Angira and Narada speaking transcendental knowledge. And then it goes to the bhakti platform, and King Chitraketu comes out from he moves from the Karma Kanda to the Jnana Kanda to the Bhagavat, or the devotional service platform, by the mercy of Narada Muni, and he becomes a great devotee. So that this, the overview of this is, there's a, in order to become a devotee, one has to have the association of one who's carrying devotion. To become a devotee, you have to contact bhakta. Those who are bhaktas, or they're carrying bhakti within their heart. And if they just, from their bhakti vessel, they just spill a little over on you, then you get bhakti. And karma and jnana, any amount of it, can't create devotion. So it's this endless Ferris wheel of enjoyment, losing the objects of your enjoyment, going spiraling down and down and down, and becoming devastated, and then coming out of it through knowledge, and getting back up to being okay again, and then having strong desires that spin you out and once again bring you down again. And the jnana and karma position are insufficient. It's the theme of the canto. So when one gets the very special opportunity, when Angira is speaking, later on he says to the king, you're so disturbed, you didn't even recognize me. And the reason that I didn't give you knowledge of devotion right off, you know, like before Harshashoka was born, is because you were too attached. You couldn't hear. And we all have that experience, don't we? People that are so attached to some desire, a desire for enjoyment, or desire for escaping the suffering of material existence. Someone is very, very attached to a material conception, to give them a spiritual conception is the beginning point before you can give them the message of real devotion. So that's the approach, at least, that Angira, the duet of Angira and Narada, take with this situation. So another time we can do this transcendental knowledge, you're not this body lesson. Everybody's got to go to work tomorrow. Any questions? Yeah.
This day I was going to the first candle.
Ah.
And there was in the first episode, was mentioning about the purpose that Jnana Kanda, Karma Kanda, and Upasana Kanda.
Upasana.
All these three things that people are going to do better children in the Kanda. So,
yeah.
Wanted to know more, say, what is Upasana Kanda, how is it different from the Karma Kanda?
Upasana means worship. And the distinction, there's divisions of Vipassana also. The Karmakanda as well involves some worship. Primarily it's worship through rituals. And with those rituals there's some devas, or the deities that are honored or propitiated in those rituals. So I guess that a short way of saying this is Upasana is tamasic, rajasic, and sattvic. And Bhagavat Dharma is the shuddha sattva portion of worship, where it's jnana karma jnanavritam. That's a short answer. Or putting in context with what I've been describing. Bhagavad Dharma, to say Karmakanda, Jnanakanda, and Shuddha Bhakti, or Bhagavad Dharma, it's the of the third division, Upasana Kanda, it's the upper portion of that Upasana Kanda. Yeah. And for that matter, Shuddha. Or approaching Shuddha Sattva. Yes?
I have a question about Brahmakanda. I just wanted to clarify my understanding.
Okay.
So in my understanding, no matter how truly you call it Brahmakanda, you can never get the Krishna.
That's right.
That help us, elevate us to the Lord.
That's right. The general position of Karmakanda is Svargaloka. If one does it in the utmost way. And so it's for material elevation, karma, kanda. And jnana, kanda, in the utmost position is sayuja mukti. But that's not attaining Krishna either.
What is sayuja mukti?
Sayuja is merging with the undifferentiated Brahman. And it's yes, and it's the interest is self-centered, as opposed to for the welfare of all, or for the pleasure of the Supreme. That doesn't appear on the screen at all. It's just I want, or I've had it. Yeah.
Bhakti Vinod Thakur also gives a very simple definition of Karmakanda, Jnanakanda, and then Bhagavad Dharma Kanda. And the one is that one is Naimitika, occasionally doing this, and the other one is Nitya. So Bhagavad Dharma is always Nitya, it's your eternal duty. The other one is occasional. And occasional can never have the result of the eternal.
And occasional also means, you know, I'm inspired when I want something, and when I get that something I want, thanks a lot, see you later.
It's always motivated.
Yeah. Yes.
So you said jnana alone cannot help one develop the tendencies for sinful activities?
Correct. It can check tendencies, but it can't uproot the tendencies.
Krishna talks about like jnana being able to destroy.
But he speaks of transcendental knowledge, and the transcendental knowledge that he's speaking of is the transcendental knowledge of pure devotion. Just like on the platform of activity or karma. There's bhakti, there's Bhog Anmukhi Sukriti, there's Moksh Anmukhi Sukriti, and there's Bhakti Anmukhi Sukriti. There's Sukriti that increases your pious position, there's Sukriti that increases your detachment position, and there's Sukriti that increases your taste for Krishna, serving Krishna. Similarly, there's transcendental knowledge that acts to detach one from material attraction, but not to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. And the message of Bhagavad Gita is to attract one to become attached to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. When Krishna speaks of, you know, in the end of chapter 4, the glories of one who becomes situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge can easily cross over the ocean of material existence. Unlimited amounts of sinful reactions can be burned in the fire of transcendental knowledge and the glories of knowledge. Now, there's degrees, like knowledge can eradicate sinful reactions. One can come to the platform of liberation. But the transcendental knowledge that Krishna is glorifying is not, it goes beyond that. Isn't it? So, the language of Bhagavad Gita and the language of the Vedas in general is such that people who have a karma kanda disposition, or people have a jnana kanda disposition, they can render it how they like to render it. And they do. Arjuna was doing that himself. As he had a predisposition. Before Krishna began speaking, his disposition was, I'm out of here. This battle is not to be fought. Look at these, and the consequences of killing my, and the soldiers being without, leaving their wives unprotected, unwanted progeny, and all these virtuous reasons I can't do it. I shouldn't do it, I won't do it, I'm leaving. So, when Krishna was saying all these glorifications of knowledge, it connected to Arjuna's wish. Let me leave my duties, karma sannyas. I'll go to the forest. I'll live in a cave, and I won't incur any reactions for any activities. I won't be doing any activities. I'll just be studying Vedanta, chanting Om, and twinkling. And then Krishna ends that chapter, the fourth chapter, saying, armed with knowledge, there's the battlefield, stand and fight. So Arjuna asks, why do you ask me to stand and fight when you say knowledge is better than fruitive work? So he's thinking knowledge means cessation of work. When transcendental knowledge means engaging in work in full consciousness of the Supreme. That's a superior knowledge. That's the transcendental knowledge that Krishna is glorifying at the end of chapter 4. Not the impersonal, stop everything, and that kind of knowledge.
So when you refer to Sanyasi, is that the goal of the impersonal knowledge?
Yes. The strength of the knowledge is sufficient to curtail those tendencies temporarily. What's the essence of, on the platform of duality, even acting piously without the focus of interest upon satisfying the Supreme Lord by Krishna. Without the focus upon satisfying the Supreme Lord, it's It's inauspicious. Although it looks like auspicious because you get the heavenly planets. And same, going to the heavenly planets or going to the Brahma Jyoti. The real interest of the soul is being lost. Attaining shelter of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord and resuming our eternal service with Him. It's what Narada told Vyas, that you've cheated the public by giving preponderance of description of this kind of thing. It's Kaitava Dharma. So, as devotees, we can understand like that, but persons who have an attitude towards Krishna, they don't see it that way. They see it transcendental knowledge means Sayuja. And so they like studying the Vedanta. They like studying the Upanishads. They like chanting Omkar. They like austerities and just, you know, intense austerities. Burning this from the senses, the desire for sense activity. So while it may hold in abeyance those desires, since according to the Bhagavatam, it's their intelligence is not sufficiently purified, avishuddha buddhaya, which is shuddha buddhi, is there's the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. That's our eternal position, to serve Him. Having not purified their intelligence in that way, one again falls down. Patantyada. Okay. Anything back here? The silent sector. Yes? No?
I wanted to understand the meaning of Kali Yuga.
Meaning of Kali Yuga?
Why we call it Kali
Yuga? Oh. Kali means quarrel. So, it's one of the symptoms of this age. Over trifles, people will argue. They'll argue and they'll go to war and they'll kill each other. Even family members. They'll just... over...
But the history of mankind is full of wars.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's especially so in Kali Yuga. It amplifies intensely in this age of Kali. In Satya Yuga, that tendency is much less. In Kali Yuga, it's much amplified.
So would it also be...
good qualities are destroyed. Just like, you know, stand in line somewhere, you know, and have somebody cut into the line. Or it's just anything. Over trifles, people, you know, have... The good qualities are lost. People not respecting, and then when somebody disrespects, just losing it, or, you know, speaking something harsh, or holding some, you know, just the disposition of mind of being forgiving, of being in the face of duality, remaining peaceful. It's greatly diminished in this age of Kali. People become angry, like. Rajagun and Tamagun are increased. It's not to say that there isn't Rajagun and Tamagun in Satya Yuga, but it's much less. In this age, Rajagun is very intense, and behind Rajagun comes Tamagun. Kamesha, Krodesha, Rajagun Samudbhava.
So, in this satyu, we have seen a lot of avatars of God coming down to earth and enriching our lives.
And Treta Yuga.
Absolutely.
And Dwarpa Yuga.
So then, what about Kali?
Do you have an answer for that? Okay. Well, in all cases, for each of the four yugas, there's a yuga avatar. And that yuga avatar, there's six kinds of avatars. Lila avatars, the Das avatars, the Lila avatars, you're familiar, right? Manvantar avatar, the Manus. Guna avatars, in charge of the modes of nature. Shaktyavesh avatars. So, another category is the Yuga avatars. They deliver the Yuga Dharma, the sacrifice for that particular age that's most effective for achieving spiritual perfection. A little overhead light. So, generally, that yuga avatar appears at the beginning of the yuga to introduce for the whole yuga. Meditation for Satya Yuga. Vedic Yajnas for Treta Yuga, Dwarapa Yuga, deity worship, Archana, and for this age, Nam Sankirtan, Sankirtan Yajna. So in the beginning of this Kali Yuga, short time after Krishna left, the Yuga avatar appeared. There's also a Lila avatar appears at the end to finish the Kali Yuga and get ready for the next Yuga. That's Kalki avatar. So he just wholesale liberates everybody. All the whatever's left of the human population is pygmyized and cannibalized, and he just liberates them. Kills them, they achieve liberation, and then the sages that are in higher dimensional regions come forward and they begin Satya Yuga. So at the beginning of this Yuga, the Yuga Dharma is introduced by the Yuga Dharma avatar. In this particular Kali Yuga, it's Lord Chaitanya. And that's identified, his coming is identified in many places, including in Mahabharata. In Vishnu Sahasranam, there's this particular sloka identifying and glorifying Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, all right. Yes. Well, this whole sixth canto is doing that.
So it seems that sometimes you can see a lot of nothing experience of the devotion. But is there anything, a better argument that can compare?
I've been doing that. I'm now repeating myself. You want a specific verse, or you want a line of logic?
Mm-hmm.
the line of logic, there's hundreds of places, but one of them is, you can look in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 5, where Narada is helping Vyas assess the Vedas. And the assessment of his assessment is that although Karmakanda can, same thing as what's here in the first chapter of the sixth canto, same line of logic. Although Karmakanda can, if done properly, neutralize the reactions of mistakes that are unavoidably going to be there, even for good people, it attracts those people to fruitive prosperity and instead of to the ultimate goal of life. And therefore, and it doesn't uproot the tendency for deviating from a virtuous path. Karmakanda doesn't uproot bad tendencies. So that line of logic is in both of those places, explicitly. So Narada, the spiritual master, the compiler of the Vedas, says you should compile one literature that just glorifies the personality of Godhead. Or in Bhagavad Gita, where it's not mentioned by name Karmakanda, but it's mentioned the worship of various devatas. Kamais taistar hritagyana prapadyante anya devata. Anya means various devatas. Karmakanda is propitiation of anya devatas through Karmakanda rituals. The predominating deity of the yajna is identified, and that's Vishnu. And then various devatas are propitiated because one, depending upon what one wants. One wants good health, and you propitiate Surya. One wants good education, Saraswati. One wants. There's various devatas to get something. So Krishna in Bhagavad Gita indicates that worship of the various devatas is performed because within the core of one's heart there's very strong material desires. But the worship of those persons, Krishna declares, is the symptom of a small intelligence, alpha medasam, because their desires are limited and temporary. So he's making that statement in comparison or in contrast to the position of taking shelter of that which is eternal. Nasate vidyate bhavo, nabhavo vidyate sataha. Second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The tattvadarshis, ubhayor apidrishtontas, tvanios tattvadarshibhi. Those who are tattvadarshis know those things that are asat, I don't place great value in them. That's Karmakanda. You're right in the way. Can you move that way? Thank you. So, and those things that are asat, those things that are sat or eternal, that's where your attention should go. And Karmakanda cannot deliver that which is sat. The devas don't have that themselves. When Hiranyakashipu requested Brahma for immortality, Brahma said, I can't give you immortality, I don't have it myself to give to you. Ask for something else. Hiranyakashipu wanted that which is asat, so he approached Lord Brahma, because that's all they can give is something asat. So there are scriptural verses and lines of logic, plenty. It's not to, so, with making such statements doesn't It's not to say that the worship of devatas is wrong. It's to say it's limited and temporary. It's Vedic. But it's for persons who will not take the direct approach and just sarva dharmam parityaja mam ekam sharanam braja. There's a verse for you. Aham tam sarva papevyo moksha yushali. So whatever it is, then another verse from Bhagavad Gita. For those who are engaged in my undivided devotional service, for such persons I preserve what they have and I carry what they lack. Whatever it is if someone has a strong desire, sarva kama, nice verse from the second chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, akama, sarva kama va, moksha kama, take your pick. No desires, all desires, desire for liberation. Whatever one's position is, tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham, because the nature of Krishna's taking care of the desires of his devotee is like with Dhruva. He takes care of the desire of the devotee in such a way the devotee will never have that desire again. Because, now this is a verse from the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, because he very cleverly gives his two lotus feet. And when the devotee gets his two lotus feet, they lose that desire. They become purified of that desire. And still, Dhruva got the planet he wanted. He got the kingdom he wanted. And he was thinking, no, no, no. And Vishnu was saying, yes, yes, yes. Not because you wanted it, but because I want a qualified person to be in that planet, ruling that planet, and that's you. Now that I've given you my two lotus feet, you're qualified, so you rule in that planet. When these divisions, this is just a general comment. When these it's not like, you know, there's algebra, there's trigonometry, and there's calculus, and you don't have calculus in the algebra class. It's like, you know, very, very clear divisions of knowledge. The Vedas aren't composed like there's a bucket over here and then there's a bucket over there and there's a bucket over there and it's either this one or that one. But it's not done like that. Just like this discussion about transcendental knowledge. It takes a discerning intelligence to understand that transcendental knowledge that Krishna is speaking about is the knowledge of pure devotion. The knowledge of working with full consciousness of the Supreme, that transcendental knowledge, as opposed to the transcendental knowledge of you're not this body, and that's transcendental knowledge too. And then what are you? Well, if you don't know who you are, you can just say, I'm not this body. I'm Brahman. So that's, it looks like Gyan Yoga. But it's not the complete message that Krishna is giving. Within the knowledge of devotion, we projected it on the wall over here, that within bhakti, knowledge is already there. It's a subset. But it's a full knowledge, the knowledge of one's relationship with the Supreme, a part of which is I'm not this body. So, bhakti is complete, and the others are partial. It's good. Worshipping devas is good compared to nothing. But it's incomplete. It's limited and temporary. And if one does that limited and temporary worship, what happens? You need a Brahmin. So I get to, then I associate with one who is situated in goodness. That's good. And by, I have to make certain sacrifices from the fruits of my accumulated work. That's good too. Little detachment. And I'm developing faith in the Vedas, which is good because the Vedas are emanations from Narayan. So that's transcendental connection, although I'm not thinking it's a transcendental connection. And as I perform those activities, and I become elevated in goodness, I start thinking, well, it's not just I want happiness in this life, but the next life. And when I start thinking about the next life, I think, well, wait a minute, what's it, it's not this body that goes into the next life, what is it that goes